Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, no one has all the answers, but we could all learn a thing or two about how to ask the right questions from my guests today, Nobel Prize winning physicist Saul Perlmutter, philosophy professor John Campbell, and social psychologist Robert McKern. I was just saying from off air, I think this is my first three-way interview. More than a decade ago, they started a popular course at the University of California to teach students to use scientific reasoning to make sense of the world. Their mission is to help us all navigate the overwhelming amount of information thrown at us every day, and their new book is called Third Millennium Thinking, Creating Sense in a World of Nonsense. We're lucky enough to have all three wise men with us now, Professor Perlmutter, Professor Campbell and Professor McKern. Hello, kia ora guys. Nice to have you on the air in New Zealand.
Great to be here.
Good to see you.
Saul, there was a time when everyone would sit up and listen to a guy who has a Nobel Prize in science, but our trust in science and scientists has taken a bit of a battering in the last few years. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's pretty clear that in general, people have become much less trusting of almost any authority figures or institutions. In fact, I guess when I've watched the polls, it looks like the scientists are still coming out relative to everybody else, but it's just that all the trust is dropping. And obviously one of the reasons that we were interested in developing this course was in trying to get a little bit at some of the underpinnings of what was going on.
Rob, what is your view on how that relationship between science and public has changed or is changing?
Well, you know, I think if you go back a century, scientists had a very exalted position. When a scientist would weigh in as an authority figure, everyone would listen and sort of genuflect to their greater wisdom and do whatever the scientist said. And I think a lot of scientists still would like it to be that way and sometimes act as if it's still that way. But I think, you know, over the 20th century, we started seeing an erosion of this automatic deferral to scientists. People became more skeptical. People started to realize that scientists sometimes have biases and values of their own. They have conflicts of interest. And so people are much more guarded today than they were in the early 20th century.
And John, what are the implications of that?
Yeah, I think what was going wrong is that we don't really have made explicit for us a sense of where the authority of science comes from. And also we don't have a good sense of what its boundaries are. I mean, people regard science as just one authority figure among the many voices clamoring in our community, telling you what to do. And I think that is really not the source of, that doesn't really get at what the source is. I mean, the sources of scientific authority is that scientists question themselves and each other about every single thing they say. It's a culture of self-challenge and of questioning the work of others. And that, in a paradoxical way, is where its authority comes from, that once you, and we all need to have a realization of where its authority comes from. But also, we need much more precision that science is authoritative about what the facts are. It doesn't tell us about what we ought to do, what values we should have. And scientists really don't have any special authority there. And we need to be very clear in our societies about where the authority comes from and what its boundaries are, so that we don't have scientists stepping over and saying, here's what you ought to do, or people saying, yeah, but these are just more authority figures. We got plenty of authority figures. We got our own authority figures. Yeah. That's not really what is going on here.
I wonder, Saul, if the part of this started, as so many things started in the pandemic, where governments needed a lot of people to do the same thing at once, and we were perhaps more unequivocal about the science or less equivocal about the science than we might otherwise have been. Because if you're if the person putting the opposite view on Facebook is completely certain of themselves, it is tempting to be a little more certain yourself, to get rid of the grey areas. Does that track for you? Do you see that as perhaps one way which we might have got wrong, even if we were forced to get it wrong by the circumstances?
No, I think that's definitely the case. That's happened now several times. I think the same thing with climate change, that there is this sense,
right,
of panic that we have to warn people about this. And so I think the scientists, to me, fell into a bit of a trap of sounding, feeling like they had to sound more authoritative than was probably the right way to build that trust that John's talking about. And of course, the pandemic, now in retrospect, it's easy to see that in some sense that ends up being part of the problem, that people then rebelled against that sense of authority, especially when it turned out that things change, that we learn things and the recommendations have to shift a little bit appropriately. I don't feel we can blame anybody for at that time, but because it's a very hard thing to figure out what to do when your people's lives are at stake and you have to figure out what to advise. But I think perhaps for the next round of the next pandemic, perhaps that's one of the things we could try to do a little better, is to remind people that we will not be telling you the absolute definitive single answer that it's going to be true forever. It's a little bit more like calling a sports play, where we're going to make our play, and then we're going to see what the virus does, and then we're going to make a different play.
Society rewards confidence. That's a bit of a problem, isn't it, Robert?
Oh, absolutely. And I've encountered this. Now, you haven't put me on the spot, but some journalists will ask me if I hedge and I say, our best evidence is, or we're not really sure, but they'll say, no, really, what do you really think? And they kind of press me to be really certain. And I've also been an expert witness. And at trial, expert witnesses are encouraged to sort of exaggerate their certainty. But that's a terrible pattern to get into. We need our scientists to tell us when they're guessing, and they say, I'm 50% certain, then they're basically guessing, which basically means don't listen to me because I really don't know. Or if, they say 85% confidence, well, then you give them more authority. If they say, really, you got to listen to me here, I really am 95% confident, then we should really pay attention. But it's a contract with the expert and the citizen. And the part of the contract is, the expert has got to use those probabilities accurately. You can't just say 95% certain when you're really guessing. And one of the problems we have is sometimes scientific authorities will exaggerate their certainty. They're overconfident, So, it's easy to judge in hindsight. But I do think public health authorities didn't always fully acknowledge that we weren't absolutely sure what the best thing to do was. And they probably should have said, look, we're 70% confident that, this particular policy is going to be a good policy. But that means, the 30% chance we're wrong, and we're going to be checking our work. And if it turns out we're wrong, we're going to adjust what we do. So I think in hindsight, health authorities probably should have expressed less confidence and said, this is new. This is new territory. We're not absolutely sure.
John, can you introduce us to a concept called calibrating our confidence levels?
Yeah, well, as Rob said, if you've got an expert that is saying, I'm 95% confident of this, then really, if they're 95% confident, then 5% of the time when they make that 95% call, they ought to be wrong. They just should be wrong if they're 95% confident. 5% of the time, they better be wrong. And yet, when people find that a scientist is mistaken, they tend to say, that shows that you were misleading us, you and your 95% chance, and it turned out to be wrong. Well, that's what calibrating yourself means, that you get exactly right the percentage of time you're going to be wrong. So if you're 80% confident, you ought to be wrong 20% of the time.
Yeah.
That's what calibrating is.
Yeah.
When you get your probabilities to line up with the number of times you're wrong.
But back to the disagreement. You talked about healthy science involving some disagreement. Have we forgotten how to do that, Saul? And have we forgotten how to do it constructively?
I mean, one of the points of the book that we've been very interested in trying to discuss is the idea that we are really, as scientists, mostly trying to figure out where we're going, where we're making mistakes. What we really want is to discover really big mistakes. We'd love to discover that we got, you know, our understanding of gravity wrong, and that we learned something, you know, completely new about how the world works. But usually we're making small mistakes, and they're, you know, we just mismeasured something or we misunderstood some analysis. The problem is that we, even when we've been taught to look for these mistakes, we're just not that good at finding our own mistakes. We're much better at finding other people's mistakes. And so what we've learned as, I think, one of the tricks of the trade of science over the years and the centuries is to work with a community of other people who understand the same concerns and the same kinds of mistakes to watch out for, and then have them help you find your own mistakes. So that was the whole idea of always having articles reviewed by others before you publish them. And in general, the whole culture of science is one where people are supposed to give you a hard time. You're supposed to show them what you're working on, and they're supposed to try to figure out what's wrong and ask you about what's wrong. And our society, I think, hasn't taken advantage of that technique, that trick. We tend to run away from people who will disagree with us, and we don't even want to hear what could be possibly wrong with, let's say, a political view that we happen to have. And it can't be true that every one of my views, you know, this whole bundle of policies that I think probably are the right policies, it can't possibly be true that they're all right, and that you know, people who grew up 20 miles away, their bundle of policies is all wrong. I mean, that seems like it would be remarkable you know, coincidence. So we need each other. We actually do need the people who will disagree with us. And I think as a society, we have to find that again. We have to get that ability to talk to each other and get help in recognizing where we're going wrong so that we can be more effective in the world.
I'm talking to the three authors of the book Third Millennium Thinking, Creating Sense in a World of Nonsense. John, you argue in the book that facts and values can coexist. How do values fit in when we're making decisions in thoughtful and deliberate ways?
Yeah, there's a real bad habit that Western culture in general has at the moment of saying, well, science does all the facts. Science tells us about the facts, but the values are all very subjective. Therefore, I can be absolutely certain about my own values and hang on to them through thick and thin. And anybody that disagrees with my values or impinges on them, I just have to coerce them by the state or by... So if I'm very much against abortion and you very much think it should be people's right, then we have a fundamental values disagreement. And the only way to resolve it is by coercion, where I either beat you down by terrorism or by seizing control of the government and making you do what I want. But that debate is impossible. But it's very important with values to think that no discussion is possible and to admit to uncertainty about what values we subscribe to and understand how to have a debate about values, which is really something we've forgotten in our general culture. And I think then we have to integrate fact and value to bring the science together with what we want and discussions about what we ought to be striving for. We again need a lot more work on just how to bring fact and value together in making decisions.
Robert, what are some of the habits of scientific thinking that can be applied to the information that comes at us every day? Can you talk to us about considering the opposite and maybe why that feels so hard?
Yeah, so... one of the things we realized in writing the book was that the culture of science, scientists learn a lot of these habits of mind, not from a textbook, but just from their colleagues and their professors and being part of a team. And, you know, so an example would be this strategy of just asking yourself, what are the different ways I could be wrong? And so a quick way to do that is, you know, you take a proposition that you believe and you just say, well, what if the opposite is true? Why might the opposite be true? And usually smart people, you know, well, most people are smart enough to quickly think of reasons why the opposite of what they believe might also somehow be true. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to change your view, but it makes you open to the possibility, yeah, that there are some ways I might be wrong. And that creates a sense of intellectual humility, which is really leaves you open to checking your work, making sure that reality is actually tracking your expectations and being a little bit more cautious in how you proceed. So there are habits like this that sort of de-bias people from all the bad mental traps. You know, another one is probabilistic thinking, learning to think not in black and white terms, but in terms of shades of gray. You know, what's the probability something is true rather than something is either true or false? And so, you know, about half our book is really trying to articulate these habits of mind that scientists cultivate.
Yeah, I love that. So there's an example. We talk a lot about confirmation bias and feedback loops. There's an example in the book where you ask students to guess how many people in their district voted for a particular candidate and what happened with their estimates and how did that change?
Of course, what happens very quickly is that people don't know anybody or very few people who voted in a way that was different from their own vote.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, people tend to live in pockets of shared, you know, political positions. So it's very easy to find evidence that will support whatever it is that you currently believe. And, of course, that's probably one of the easiest examples. But in general, you know, when you go to look for an argument on the web, you're much more likely to read the whole argument if it's something that is fits with something that you want to believe,
yeah.
Or that you already do believe. And so a lot of you know, one of the big challenges is to figure out, you know, how do you get yourself to be open to positions that you would not you know, ordinarily you know, want to jump in on. We give it one very interesting technique that is becoming part of actually the science world, which is to hide from yourself conclusions before you've decided how robust the advice is. So, you know, if you're, let's say, trying to choose a website in which it's going to give you medical advice, it's a bad idea to read through all of the websites until you find one that gives you the advice you want to hear, and then that one. So really what you want to do is you want to hide from yourself what advice it gives on your particular medical situation, and first evaluate which website is a safer bet, you know, which one seems to be more authoritative and has better evidence and is showing its work and showing you in which ways it's could be wrong and where it could be right. And once you've found one that you trust, then you let yourself read what it recommends for your particular case. And you may like it, you may not, but at least you'll trust that it's probably not, you didn't just choose it because it's what you wanted to hear.
John, tough one for you. What do you hope people take away from this book?
Optimism and an ability to talk across tough barriers, barriers that divide us. I mean, it seems to me that we have a lot of free speech now, maybe more than at any other time in history, where anyone can get onto social media and post potentially to millions of people. And we have all this free speech, but we don't have the benefits of it, because the whole point of free speech is to let us debate, let us test ideas, let us find out what's right and what's wrong. I mean, we all have to be thinking probabilistically. We all have to be open to the idea that we might be wrong, and we need to test ideas. And what's going wrong at the moment is that free speech isn't serving its purpose. we are feeding our views out to these echo chambers, and we just get it back what we already thought. And we need to be able to use our enormous freedom of speech to open debates across difficult subjects, rather than what we all do at the moment, simply hoping that your side will gain power and beat down the other side, which, you know, is a good short-term fix, but it's not really long-term tenable, yeah. And it's leading to a real crisis in civilizations at the moment. So the whole idea is that we should be able to use free speech to get the benefits it's supposed to of airing and testing ideas.
Robert, how does this stuff go down with your students, many of whom will be in an age group who might be the generation most sure of their own views and most resistant to having them challenged? That's my editorial analysis there. You may disagree.
Well, I am going to disagree in a sense. So I understand the problem is that younger generations are most active in social media, and I think a lot of us see social media is working very badly right now. So in that sense, younger people are especially immersed in this sort of toxic social media culture. At the same time, I think they understand what's happening. And what we find with our students is there's actually a real hunger to sort of break out of this pattern. They sense that something's wrong. And so we get a very enthusiastic response to these ideas among our students because they have a sense that surely we can all do better than this, but they're not quite sure how to extract themselves from this crazy situation we're in. And just to give you a very concrete example, in my own field, psychology, we've had this replication crisis, due to some bad methodological habits in the field. But it's really been the younger scholars who've led the way toward trying to change the culture and improve the methodologies. The senior scholars are very defensive and trying to say, no, we don't have a crisis. What crisis? What crisis? But it's the younger scholars who are saying, oh, come on, we can do better than this.
I'm pleased to hear it. And there's a little bit of optimism there. Guys, well done on the book. Thank you for starting this conversation. And thanks so much for joining us on air in New Zealand today, talking about it. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Wonderful.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, the book is called Third Millennium Thinking, Creating Sense in a World of Nonsense. And I've been speaking with Nobel Prize winning physicist Saul Perlmutter, philosophy professor John Campbell, and social psychologist Robert McCoon.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.